Morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
We'll proceed with our docket. Starting out, of course, with Carlton Shell versus the Commonwealth. Mr. McCracken, good to see you again.
Great to see you, Judge.
Good to see you as well, too. You want any time in rebuttal?
Why don't I try 10 and 5? Judge, as you know, it normally doesn't work out that well for me, but I'll try anyway.
So we'll put 5 down.
Yes, sir.
You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. As always, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Barry McCracken. I'm here from the Norfolk Public Defender's Office on behalf of Carlton Shell. Mr. Shell was convicted in Norfolk Circuit Court of failing to register under the sex offenders list. The case involves a very narrow issue. There's no dispute that basically that the indictment alleged he failed to re-register, I think, or provided false information, as I noted in the brief. Although they never sorted it out, the clear indication was that this was a failure to re-register. It had nothing to do with false information. And the basic argument was that he did not re-register when he changed his address within 3 days, and I believe the date that they were using was the 23rd of February 2013. The difficulty and the reason we're here is the Commonwealth failed to put any evidence at trial that he had a predicate offense that required such registration or re-registration. What they did put in, it was a felony offense, and so it was alleged as a second or subsequent offense. It was actually, I think, the fourth offense, at least based on the evidence that was introduced. There were 3 prior convictions, 3 misdemeanor convictions that were offered. 2 in 2008, 1 in 2009. The date of the last offense of those prior convictions, I believe, was January of 2009. What happened here, of course, is the Commonwealth introduced evidence of an abduction conviction, I think, from the Chesapeake Circuit Court in 1993. The problem is that's all it said was abduction. It didn't show that it met any of the criteria on the sex offender list, which requires either a victim that's either a minor, physically incapacitated or mentally incapacitated to have accomplished the act. There's nothing in the record that established that conviction had any of those elements.
It doesn't exclude that possibility. It just doesn't confirm it.
It doesn't. Well, the Commonwealth's argument at trial, and I think Mr. Darren's argument is essentially that you can infer that since there was that conviction, it must have been under the subparagraph A that's required for registration purposes. The problem with that is there's nothing that shows that. That conviction, really, that abduction conviction, is no more relevant to his requirement to register than if it was a petty larceny offense or a DUI, because there's no nexus between those prior convictions and that abduction. We didn't have his entire criminal history. We don't know what it was. I mean, their inference is, well, we know he had an abduction conviction, so that must have been...
If you have an order that doesn't specify like this, what do you do? Do you bring in the transcript of the trial? Do you...
I think what they've done in the past, and of course what the Commonwealth attempted to do, I mean, let's not hide the ball too much here. They attempted to offer a pre-sentence report to establish the element. That pre-sentence report was not admitted into evidence, so it's not there.
Well, then you get into hearsay problems.
Well, that's why it's not there. They didn't even have an authentic copy. They came up with a copy of a copy of a copy. There were any number of reasons. That's really not before this court. But I mean, the truth of the matter is that abduction conviction standalone is not relevant to anything that's before the trial court, because they'd never established that it constituted a predicate offense. They didn't put in the entire criminal history, so you said the trial judge was forced to speculate that somehow that abduction conviction had some relevance to this proceeding or the prior misdemeanor proceeding.
Well, the court extrapolated from the fact that he continued to register.
Well,
and presumably the state police isn't interested in having folks. I mean, they have enough on their hands without. So if you commit a larceny, they're not going to come after you and say, "Hey, register as a sex offender."
It would all, in all due respect to both your observation and the state police, they do get it wrong at times.
Well, sure.
And all we're saying here is that the fact that Ms. Darren's tried to make an inference that I am trying to collaterally attack those misdemeanor convictions. I am not. I mean, that's a bit of a red herring.
Failure of proof argument.
It's just a failure of proof. you know, we know that he may have had a duty to register in January of 2009 does not mean he necessarily had a duty to register in February of 2013. Those are two different things. That's 4 years in there, and any number of things could have happened that caused his obligation to register to go away.
We have some evidence. I mean, it's maybe circumstantial. I don't know if that's the right way to characterize it, but he's registered before, so presumably because he felt he had a duty to register. So it's not that there's zero evidence. It's just a question of, is that enough?
Exactly. And our position, of course, I mean, there's some inferences can be drawn. Obviously, he's been registering. We don't dispute that. He acknowledged that he changed his address and didn't re-register as the state police wanted him to. But it is the Commonwealth's burden to come forward with proof that is beyond speculation, required that allows the trial judge to draw reasonable inferences from the evidence that was presented.
There's a criminal charge has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
And what we're saying is that basically, although there's certainly, as you said, there's some evidence, and I'm not suggesting there's not a strong suspicion here that he had a duty to register. But I am suggesting that there's just a fundamental failure of proof here. It required the judge to take a leap of faith from the fact that he had a conviction in 09, that he still had that whatever obligation it required that he was required to do that conviction symbolizes in 2009 remained in effect in 2013, whatever it was. I mean, the trial judge is making decision in this case had to guess because the abduction is not shown to be relevant. I mean, they made an effort, it failed, and actually had my colleague down below had realized where they were going with this, he should have moved to strike to disallow the admission of the abduction conviction because it wasn't relevant at that point in time when they failed to tie the loop. It essentially came in as conditionally relevant.
Right, I was going to say.
And they failed to establish the condition. He should have moved. But, he still raised the same issue. He just did it with a motion to strike. I mean, that doesn't mean he assumed that was relevant. He simply said, look, you've got an abduction conviction that's standing alone. It's not relevant to anything. It does not establish a predicate offense. And to try to use that in conjunction with a prior conviction that didn't reference that abduction. None of the misdemeanor offenses referenced abduction as the underlying offense. They simply said he was guilty. He pled guilty and he was guilty 4 years earlier.
We know that he is a convicted sexual offender.
Well, we don't know that. Well, we know that he had been determined that in the past. Okay. I mean, we know that, but we do not know. I mean,
are you saying all of that prior is void because of the...
I'm not saying it's void, no, sir. I'm just saying you cannot make a conclusion that because he was required to register in 2009, he's still required to register in February without some showing of a predicate offense that required it.
I mean, any predicate offense or just a continuing...
A continuing predicate offense.
A continuing obligation... Once determined to be...
Well, you can be removed from the writ list. I mean, actions can be taken. I mean, there are some things. A writ of actual innocence can be granted. That doesn't have a time.
That's not the issue in this case.
No, sir. All I'm saying is what we have, we've got a prior conviction from 2009 and 8. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, they all kind of stand alone, stand on the same basis. Those are prior convictions that, if at best established, the trial judge in 2009 was satisfied he had a predicate offense that required him to register. But you can't jump that 4 years ahead and said just because it existed in January of 2009, it of necessity continued to exist in February of 2013.
You said you can be removed from the list?
You get a decree of actual innocence as to the underlying offense, you're off.
But has that occurred in this case?
Don't know.
Well,
the question is, Judge, and that when you ask that question, and if I cut you off, I apologize.
No, you're fine.
The problem with that analysis is it's not a question of whether or not he's got a defense. It's a question of whether or not the Commonwealth proved the predicate that there existed at the time that they say he had a duty to register, an existing predicate offense.
And he had registered before.
He had registered before, yes, sir. And that may have been an error. I mean, the whole thing about the Alford plea and whether or not it was, the prior conviction established the predicate offense simply went there. Any number of reasons, as Judge McCullough pointed out, state police have a lot on their plate. They don't want people registering that don't have to register, but they make mistakes all the time. And quite often, this is a system that goes on where the trooper is the individual that's telling the individual his obligation to register, not register. And the troopers don't always get it right. We don't always get it right. What they're saying is the only thing we've got in evidence here is a prior conviction that established an obligation in 2009. And I'm saying from that alone, and it doesn't establish what that predicate conviction was, and it's not before the trial judge.
Counsel, what about the other failure to registers? I mean,
that established that he had an obligation up to the last date of a conviction, and that would have been January the 12th of 2009. Okay. I see I've run over my 10 minutes as we knew I would, but I'll save any questions you might have for that last 4 minutes.
We'll try to save them.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Leah Darren for the Commonwealth. Your Honors, the state police may not always get it right, but they are presumed under the law to get it right. The evidence in this case showed, number one, that the defendant had been convicted of a qualifying offense. Number two, that he was registered. He conceded in the trial court and the custodian of the records of the sexual offender registry who testified in this case. The testimony of those two individuals showed, number one, he had a qualifying offense. Number two, he was registered. Number three, he had three prior offenses for failing to re-register. Number four, we put on evidence, the Commonwealth put on evidence at trial that, and he conceded, that he had not re-registered within 3 days of moving from one address to another, and in fact, it had been several months, and the defendant said to the trooper who was investigating this offense that he had just been too busy. So,
other than a writ of actual innocence, which is, my knowledge, you can count on the fingers of one hand how many of those have been granted. Do you know of any other way you can drop off of this registry? I don't know of any.
I haven't heard of any, but what I would say is that under the circumstances, what the Commonwealth had to prove was that he was registered and that he had failed to comply with the registration requirements. Those were the elements that the Commonwealth had to prove. Now, if the defendant had, even after pleading guilty to priors, if this defendant had suddenly realized that he'd been improperly put on the registry, that regardless of the presumption of regularity that attached to the state police actions putting him on the registry, he had to do something. He had to.
In other words, the burden was on him to knock out the presumption at that point.
Exactly. That's right. And he doesn't meet that burden by saying, well, we don't know what kind of abduction this man was convicted of, so therefore the evidence was insufficient to support the conviction. No, the evidence in this case was plainly sufficient to support the conviction, and we ask that the conviction be affirmed. If there are no further questions.
I've got sort of a minor one. That he was saying he was living a place that when the trooper, I think, went to that place, they had no idea of who this person was, the person who was in occupying that residence.
That's right. The witness's name was Ms. Rodigan, and she said, I think that's right, started with an R, I apologize, and she said she had been living at that residence for several months. The defendant was not one of her roommates, and that she didn't even know him.
I mean, I was trying to remember from reading through the record that it was something that struck my fancy.
Sugarfoot. I'm sorry, I can't come up with the page number on that just right off the top of my head. I apologize.
And I don't think that was in dispute.
That was not in dispute.
It was not. In fact, I believe he conceded it. He said he was too busy to re-register. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Dern. Mr. McCracken, you have your few minutes to...
Well, I'm not, obviously you didn't belabor it much with the AG, so I'm not going to belabor it too much. the only thing that I would note, she started off by saying they proved a predicate offense, and what predicate offense did they prove? They didn't prove a predicate offense. That's the whole point here. You know, just because there's an abduction in his past, you can't assume that it wanted one that meets the requirements. And the fact that we presume that the police do their business in an orderly course is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And it does not allow you to assume that because the trooper thought he should register that and his failure to do so, therefore, is sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, what about the defendant's comment to the officer about he was just too busy to register? Is that an admission
Have registered? I mean, the one thing that is not in dispute is that he moved and didn't register. We're not there. That was never in dispute. The only issue is did they establish the fundamental element of the offense, which I think she overlooked. The fundamental element is they have to show he had a duty to register.
But if he admits that he had a duty to register, isn't that evidence that he should have registered?
Well, he didn't say he had a duty to register. He said he didn't register. That doesn't necessarily, I mean, those are two different issues. One is there a predicate offense that establishes his legal obligation to be there? Just because he's on the register, if he has no legal obligation to be there, whether he's been registering for 20 years, doesn't...
But again, you've got several facts that you can put together.
Exactly. The question is, can you take what facts they have here and make the jump of logic that he necessarily had, that what they had was adequate for the court to infer the existence of a predicate offense, although she has no knowledge, nor does this court have any knowledge, any evidence from front end from which you can determine what that predicate offense is. We keep talking about this abduction, but there's nothing to show that in the record, and that's all the judge and you can make that decision from, there is nothing in this record that establishes that abduction has anything to do with his duty to register or not register.
The only thing we really know is that he thought he was required to register.
Yes, sir.
He had re-registered, and then he didn't re-register.
Right.
Because he just didn't take the
time. And that is not on the table. I mean, that was not part of the only issue that's focused here is whether or not from the evidence as it was presented, and we all know what it is. I mean, we've all kind of gone at it. But what it really simply comes down to is can you infer from without knowledge of what that predicate offense may or may not be that there exists a valid predicate offense based on the fact that he was convicted for failing to register 4 years before and that he had been registered. I don't think the presumption of regularity of the police activities are sufficient. I don't think the fact that he may have had an obligation 4 years ago establishes that he has an obligation 4 years later. I mean, there are any number of things that could come up. You're right, Judge. I acknowledge that. I mean, a petition of actual innocence is about as rare as a dodo. But it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And what we're really talking about...
Where we're going with that is, I mean, a court can have doubt, but it has to be a reasonable doubt. And so that's what I'm trying to figure out.
I understand. The problem I have is that we get into these things, and had they put enough evidence on the table from which the judge could make that logical jump such that the defendant was had a duty to come forward with some evidence rebut it, and I don't think they had. I mean, it is an element of the defense, and it is their burden to come forward with that evidence. They failed to do so, and I think my client is entitled. That's what motions to strike are all about. My client's entitled on their failure of proof, and that's what we have here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. McCracken. We'll come down and now greet counsel personally to thank you for your arguments. Take up.